I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about emotional first aid, and thanks for listening. In Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. My motto is, as you probably know by now, life is surprising. Surprising in every way. The question is, which surprises throw you off balance, temporarily or in a serious way? It's not just negative things that can throw us. Winning the lottery, meeting the person of your dreams, even getting a golden parachute can throw you. This is the stuff of everyday psychological wounds, which can range from mild to severe and how they affect us. Reading this new book, I was surprised to learn that our brains experience rejection as if it were a serious physical wound. What does this say about the young person asking somebody to a dance, being fired, bullied, or treated distantly or disrespectfully, even violently, because of age, race, gender, orientation, physical ability? Many years ago, when my sister's husband died at the age of 42 from a sudden heart attack, my sister, who was now caring alone for four children, attempted to socialize with a group of couples, and she came home and she said she felt like an outcast, and she was in tears, and I thought she imagined it. But one of the women told her bluntly, "Now that your husband has died, the others are going to feel you're going to try and steal their husbands." The fury I felt at that kind of insensitivity is just indescribable. What my sister felt was devastated, wounded for a long time as a result of this remark. And she did get grief counseling and recovered fully. The point is that wounds come at us through intended and unintended circumstances. A group decides to shun you, a boss puts a target on your back, you're dumped by someone, or spurned when you ask for a date. The question we're trying to answer is, what are the useful, practical strategies for handling everyday wounds like rejection, failure, and guilt to be at your best, self-esteem intact? I hope you'll jump in and ask questions on this call-in show. Our guest is Manhattan psychologist Dr. Guy Winch, who's author of this book, Emotional First Aid. He writes the Squeaky Wheel blog for Psychology Today, and we've summarized some of his tips online, posted now, along with our usual recipes and wines for dinner at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Thanks for being on the show, Guy.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I think the one that captivated me the most, and this is one of the wounds that you stress early on in the book, and that's rejection. I was very surprised about this idea that when you look at brain scans, even a simple rejection, you know, one of those everyday rejections, shows up as pain in the brain.
And I was surprised as well when I read that research, because we all know that rejection hurts. But really what that research showed was that it's activating the same pathways in the brain exactly as get activated when we experience physical pain. And there really is no other emotional wound or emotion in that way that does that, that really makes us feel this sharp, sharp pain that is so similar to physical pain. And in fact, the expression hurt feelings, which is usually a result of rejections, is universal in almost every language. They refer to the pain and the hurt because I think that people experience it so exclusively as physical pain when it happens.
The tough ones among us, well, I can just hear it now. You know, people saying, "Oh, please, grow up. This is the way life is." Of course, this is the way life is.
Yes, but those people would also say, when you broke a leg, "Oh, don't whine about it. Grow up. That's the way tough life is." In other words, the people who I think who would dismiss the idea that emotions can be very painful would probably dismiss the idea that you get any kind of sympathy for any kind of pain you might experience.
So, we hear this about bullying. I remember when we, as a culture, really started looking at this because you know, kids were starting to commit suicide, and it has really gotten bad, and so or hurt other people, and so that's where we first heard from a group saying, you know, this is some kind of coddling. Rejection, though, in particular, we're going to get into other kinds of everyday wounds, but rejection in particular, you say, causes these four distinct psychological wounds. Let's go through them one by one.
Let's see. I just want to actually, just before that, quickly just comment on the other thing you raised, and that is that, in general, part of why I wrote this book is that there's a real favoritism we have towards our physical well-being and not towards our emotional well-being. In other words, the people that feel that you know, people who are bullied are just being coddled if they're feeling too much despair, or that we shouldn't spend too much time thinking or dealing with the pain of rejection. The whole idea is that they would never suggest that somebody really who had a physical injury not take care of that injury. They wouldn't suggest that. But they would suggest that somebody who has an emotional injury would not take care and would be dismissive of that. And that's a real difference that is, I think, truly about ignorance and about people not really understanding how profoundly we are impacted. And so, indeed, there are four ways that we get wounded by rejection. And the first and foremost is physical pain. Rejection is the most common of these emotional daily injuries that we can sustain. It just happens everywhere. And these days, one of the actually places I hear that it happens even most is on social media. Because when people don't like our posts on Facebook and they don't retweet our tweets on Twitter, people actually feel very hurt by that. And people do talk about that, both in sessions when I'm in private practice, and in general, people talk about the fact that they feel rejected when people are not responsive to them on social media. So the opportunities for rejection are really, they're all around us, and that's why it happens.
So there's more of it, you're saying, because of social media.
Well, much, much more of it. I mean, truly, people will say things, you know, will really feel, if you went and you liked your friend's vacation pictures or their child pictures, or they put a picture of their new grandchild or son or daughter, and you liked it, and then you put up a picture of your new grandchild or son or daughter, and they didn't like it back, you're going to feel hurt and rejected. Most people will. Now, the truth is that maybe they didn't see it, maybe they saw it and smiled and will say something to you next time, but in the moment, their hands were busy, they just didn't have a free thumb with which to press the like on their phone. But we'll experience that as something that's unaccepting or something that's rejecting. And people will measure their popularity sometimes by their impact and the responses they get on social media, on Facebook, etc. And so it really does set people up to feel rejection in this whole new way and a way that's really ubiquitous to our lives at the moment.
Well, Guy, what about this part? Because I recently had a dispute with a colleague over something, and I realized that in this, I misunderstood something, and really what was behind it is that my feelings were hurt, and I was embarrassed to admit that. And so I think it's hard to ask yourself or examine how hurt you are over something you judge yourself for. You think you shouldn't be hurt in some kind of circumstance. It's embarrassing to admit to other people that something has hurt you if you feel like you should not have done whatever. You know, what about that embarrassment?
Well, I think that's a huge thing. And to me, I mean, one of my hopes with this book was that if more people understood that there's a really automatic response of emotional hurt when we experience rejection, that everyone experiences it to some degree or another. Now, we might dismiss it, we might try to squelch it, but we do feel it. We all feel it. And that's what some of these studies were so interesting in showing. You know, in one study, for example, people were put through a rejection experience and were then told that the person who rejected them, who was actually a research confederate, which they didn't know, so they were told, oh, that person who rejected you was here for another experiment. They're members of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, does it still hurt that they rejected you? And people had to admit that, yeah, it still hurts. Even when the person who's rejecting us is somebody we might despise, it still hurts. And then they told the subjects, well, actually, you know, it was a research confederate. The rejection wasn't real, and it still hurt. In other words, rejection is so fundamental, and our response to it is so deep, that even hearing that it actually didn't happen wasn't enough to undo the pain people felt. They got over it, you know, quickly, but they still felt the icky feeling for quite a while after that, even after hearing that it never really happened, that it was fake.
So that sounds like we're hardwired for this.
We are hardwired for it, and that's the point. If we all assumed that we are hardwired, and we all knew that about ourselves and about other people, there'd be much less embarrassment about admitting, oh, that hurt my feelings, because right now we feel that admitting that hurt my feelings is a statement about us. And truly, it's not necessarily a statement about us. Mm-hmm. It's a statement about us as humans, but not us as individuals.
Yeah, not personal. So this is why, if we're hardwired for this, and even knowing that the fake Ku Klux Klan was behind your thing, and you still feel this hurt, it goes to show that the logical response to get out of this, why that doesn't always work.
Right. I mean, exactly. When you try and just and talk yourself down, you have a hard time doing it because, you know, I mean, if hearing that the thing never really happened, that it was a fake encounter, or that the person mm-hmm. was somebody you despise doesn't do it, then there's little you can do to try and reason with rejection in that moment. Why I think it is important to reason with it, though, is because while you can't make that sting go away, you can certainly make it worse by piling on self-criticism, by piling on self-blame. And that is something that's a way in which we have to address rejection as well. In other words, rejection wounds us in a certain way, but then we add on to that wound by going around and saying, well, what's wrong with me? Why am I such a loser? You know, and we're so self-critical after those kinds of things, and we're really just taking a wound and making it worse. Again, something we would never do in the physical domain. We would never get a cut and then not bandage it and try and expose it to bacteria. But in a way, that's what we're doing with rejection when we develop this negative self-talk, which so many of us do. So we count, you know, we add to the pain, we add to the difficult feelings that we have, we add to the erosion of our self-esteem, and that's not necessary.
This is Manhattan psychologist and Psychology Today blogger Dr. Guy Winch. He's author of Emotional First Aid, about practical strategies for treating rejection, failure, guilt, and other everyday psychological injuries so that you can be at your best no matter what life tosses your way. And as we all know, life can really toss some things. So much for logic. You say that romantic rejection is especially potent.
Romantic rejections are especially potent because we feel very vulnerable in those situations. And that is actually the situation in which we are most likely to then do damage ourselves. For example, it's very, very common for somebody who's been rejected romantically to really kind of go on this search and destroy mission with their self-esteem, where they'll start to think of all their faults and all their ways in which they were inadequate, even if they're not inadequate. You know, maybe I wasn't tall enough or blonde enough or smart enough or this enough or that enough or rich enough or whatever it is. You know, we'll go and we'll think about, oh, we got rejected because we're not good here, and this person is better at us, and that one's better is better looking than us. And it's such an unnecessary thing, because romantic rejections almost every single time are about an issue of match, of chemistry. It's we didn't fit. It's a lock and a key, and our lock didn't fit their key. Now, it could be that the key saw it before the lock did, or the lock sees it before the key does, but at some point, it doesn't work between the two people. It's not necessarily a personal thing. Somebody might have a very specific type in mind, or somebody might be getting over an old relationship and being looking for the opposite of whatever that was. And if you don't happen to fit that bill, then you're not going to do, no matter how great you are, but it's no test. It's no statement about you or your worth, or even your worth in the dating sphere. And so it's really important after romantic rejections, A, to try and heal that wound so that you can go out there and not try and avoid those scenarios, because that's not good either, and B, so that you don't get too hard on yourself and blame yourself for things that you're really not to blame for.
All right, Dr. Guy Winch, please stay right where we are. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about emotional first aid some more, including a report from the Office of the Surgeon General of the United States about social rejection. Stay with us. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see the book, what we're talking about, and some of the high points from the book. It's called Emotional First Aid. You'll also find all of our recipes of value wines, cocktails, easy cocktails right now online at WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. We are talking with Dr. Guy Winch. He is a practicing psychologist in Manhattan, a blogger for Psychology Today, and he's done this book about practical strategies for what everyday wounding, you know, the things that life throws at that everybody. These are the things that we both swallow and skip right by, and the things that are just so devastating. Guy, you said that in 2001, the Office of the Surgeon General of the U.S. issued this report that found social rejection to be the greater risk factor for adolescent violence than gang membership, poverty, or drug use. That's astounding.
It is astounding, and it's been found over and over again, even in very small studies in which people, again, looked at certain rejection scenarios and then looked at people's behavior afterwards and saw how they really acted out this aggression, and they didn't necessarily connect it to the rejection they experienced. They just felt aggressive and angry afterwards. And that's something that really is common with rejection. It's one of the big reasons for violence against women is men who experience real or assumed rejection, sometimes without it actually even being there. Of course, these are violent people to begin with. But rejection really does cause us a surge in anger and in aggression, and we have to know that. And again, why we have to know these things is because there are steps we can take to mitigate them, to mitigate the anger, to mitigate the hurt, to mitigate the damage to our self-esteem. And in a way, I wrote this book because we all have these medicine cabinets at home where we have our bandages and our ointments and our band-aids and for all the kinds of physical daily wounds we get, but we don't have the equivalent for emotional and psychological wounds. And it exists. It just existed in the literature and no one in the research literature, and no one had actually distilled it for people to use in their daily lives.
Yeah. Let's get into some of the things that you can do. We're focusing hard on rejection. I know there are all kinds of other things we're going to get into in this hour, but we have a call from Kelly at 203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. Kelly, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking this call, Faith.
Sure.
I was just wondering if the doctor agreed with my thoughts on this would be that the persons, I'm speaking adults, the persons who do usually hurt your feelings in these ways are usually, for lack of a better term, the quote-unquote bullies. And I think that there's only 10 or 20% of the people who are doing most of this hurtings of feelings. I wonder if he agrees with that or if he feels, other than the times when, yes, your hands were too busy and you couldn't text somebody back, you liked a picture, other than that type of thing. He thinks it's usually the same.
Yeah, Kelly, that's a good question to ask. So, Dr. Winch, welcome. So, Dr. Winch, how often does it happen that it is the bully doing this, or can it be the everyday person who just has poor judgment, who just suddenly because of other peers decides to be mean?
Well, you know, in fact, I think a little differently there. I really think that it's the everyday person, period, and not somebody necessarily trying to be mean. Yes, of course, there are bullies who try and do these things, you know, on purpose, and they are the mean-spirited people, the inconsiderate people who just don't care how you feel. They'll just do whatever they do, and that might hurt your feelings. But most of what we experience on a day-to-day is, you know, if somebody asks somebody out and they say no, they're not being a bully by saying no. They're just not interested. If three colleagues from work get together and go to lunch and they didn't invite the fourth person, it could be they had a pre-standing friendship, they don't necessarily know that fourth person, they're not doing anything bad by going to lunch without them, but the fourth person is sitting in the office watching three other people go and feeling very left out by it. And so the problem is that so many of the rejections we experience, and this is why they're so common, you know, it doesn't take a very big mean bully or a mean person to do it. It just happens around us. You know, we can lose our jobs and feel rejected, and that's because of, you know, cutbacks or all kinds of different factors, and no one was trying to be mean, but yet our feelings can be incredibly hurt.
I was just thinking maybe there should be classes in how to reject other people, because you don't necessarily want to accept a date or have dinner or whatever it might be. Maybe there isn't a position for this person in a company, and how do you reject someone well so that they're, you know, you can minimize the wound as much as possible. Let's switch over to treatment for this. If we've got Band-Aids in a medicine cabinet, how do we, let's stay with rejection for a minute. One of the things is that you pointed out we can start beating ourselves up over rejection. I'm sure this happens with asking somebody on a date a lot. How do you argue with yourself about this?
Well, one of the, in the book, I give a whole list of different kinds of arguments for different kinds of domains, whether it's the workplace, professional, or dating, etc. But really, you have to, you know, there was this famous line from Seinfeld in which somebody said, "Oh, it's not you, it's me," when they were breaking up with that person. And I go for that. In other words, if the person is telling you, "I'm breaking up with you, but it's not you, it's me," believe them. It's them. There's no reason to assume it's you. In other words, they might be not ready for a relationship. They might be commitment phobic. They might be, you know, I say in the book things like, you know, their best friend might be the neighborhood drug dealer and you might be a cop. So they think, well, it's not going to work out. There's so many reasons why that might happen. And since you don't know, the problem is, why fill in that gap of not knowing with something that makes you look bad? Why not fill in the gap that something makes the other person look bad and you look fine?
Let me present a situation where we've all met these people. This is someone who perhaps never stops talking. And this can be maddening after a while. And so that long talker asks somebody out, and the person thinks, oh, I would be driven mad by this. And so, gee, thanks, but I just don't think this is going to work. Now, the person asking for the date has got some things to deal with. And so should you say to yourself, this has nothing to do with me, all the time?
I'm actually for a very quick inspection of your culpability. In other words, I'm not saying don't look at all at your behavior. By all means, look at it briefly, but really go only on facts. Don't try and invent things because you're not sure. So that long talker has probably gotten feedback before in their lives that they're long-winded. They must have. Whether in school, from friends and colleagues, at work, they must have gotten that feedback. And so if you've gotten feedback repeatedly that you're a little bit long-winded, you have to be mindful of that when you're on a date. You have to be mindful of allowing the other person to talk. And that's something you have to be aware of. So, yes, I'm all for looking at our part when we have a reasonable suspect. And if you've been told something about yourself before that could be a reasonable suspect and you think that might have had a role in it, then maybe it had a role in it, and that's just something to look out for and be more mindful of in the future.
How do you say no thanks to somebody, minimizing the damage?
And it's an interesting thing, right? Because it depends on a lot of different factors. You know, the question is, you're saying no thanks, this is online before you've met the person, is this after one date? Is this after three dates? Is this after 2 weeks, after 2 months? And I do think different lengths and different things require a different level of disclosure. For example, if you've just had one date with someone and you're not interested and they don't contact you, you don't need to contact them and say, I'm not interested. They're not contacting you, so there's no reason to go and put it in their face in that way. Some people say, oh, I should always say that. But all right, and if you're going to say it, I would just say the thing that's most real, like, I had a very nice time meeting you. I don't feel it's a romantic match for me, but I really wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. How about, you know, there's some kind of chemistry that we can't even put into words. I just don't feel that chemistry is there. It sounds like something magical in the air, you know, that kind of a thing where nobody's to blame here. It's just not working.
Right. And then I would really say something like that. You know, I think I really enjoyed hanging out and I really think you're a great person. I just don't feel enough of a spark. And I wish I did, but I don't. And I just thought, you know, rather than go on, and I'd let you know now. And again, I really wish you the best. And again, if you're saying it just reasonably and you're explaining it and you're saying it nicely, it's going to hurt the other person because, as we said, these things hurt regardless. But at least they won't have to start thinking that, well, maybe I said something or did something or maybe I wore the wrong thing or, you know, that kind of thing. It just helps people not have to fill in the gaps with all kinds of self-deprecating ideas when they're not necessary.
You know, I was in a situation once where it was a perfectly wonderful person. I was asked out on a date. I didn't have such a great time, and I said, you know, this thing about the chemistry. And the other person said, oh, that's too bad. I thought there was really something here. And I said back, I know. You know, I mean, in both of us, it was a mutual kind of sympathy over the situation. And so it really, I don't think anybody lost face in this.
And you know what's very, very common in my private practice? People will say to me all the time in the dating scenario, you know, I went out with this person. I really, really liked them. I just didn't feel the spark. I wish I did because they're so great.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens a lot. So the person who's saying no might think you're really great.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Didn't quite reach the tipping point.
That's now that would be a great thing to say. Loneliness. This is another thing you talk about as an emotional wound, common in everyday life, sometimes profound for people.
And you know, loneliness. What I was most surprised at when I was doing the research for that was that the health consequences of loneliness are almost as dramatic as the mental health, emotional health consequences of loneliness. We know that loneliness, when people are lonely, and especially when they're chronically lonely, it can really lead to depression. It can lead to early Alzheimer's disease, to a more rapid progression of Alzheimer's disease. It can put people more at risk for cardiovascular disease. And there are studies that say that if you add up, oh, and here's another one, it really suppresses our immune system functioning. In one study, they looked at college freshmen coming in who just got the flu shot. And in the part of the health questionnaires, they asked them if they were feeling lonely. And they found, when they looked at it, that the students who reported they were feeling lonely had a much poorer response to the flu shot than the other students did because their immune system was suppressed. Mm-hmm. And what we know is that the risk factors for chronic loneliness are as significant for our long-term health and our longevity as the risk factors for smoking cigarettes.
Well, what about the kind of hidden loneliness, I call it, where people now, the jobs are so overwhelming because of platforms and you know, smaller numbers of employees, people doing so many, that people are working all the time, and while you're interacting with lots of people, there's not that, the workplace is really not that place for real solid connection and intimacy. And so people spend shorter and shorter amounts of time with friends, you know, at home. And so that normal connection that you would have is missing. What do you do?
And so, look, that's a very, very good point, because one thing about loneliness is it's a subjective definition. Loneliness doesn't have objective criteria. It is whether the person feels significantly emotionally or socially disconnected from others around them. Somebody might be married, somebody might seem to have a lot of friends, but they might still feel profound loneliness because there's a fundamental disconnection perhaps with their spouse or from all those friends. There's not a real connection that runs very, very deep with any of them. And so you can be in a workplace, you can be surrounded by people all day, you can go home even to a spouse and still feel very, very lonely for the reasons that you said. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a subjective thing, and it's not, and it's hidden in the sense that, okay, that person doesn't look lonely on the face of it, but many, many people who experience really deep loneliness don't look it on the face of it if you look at just the circumstances of their life. But if you look at how they feel, then they're absolutely lonely, and they have all the symptoms, quote unquote, of somebody who does feel significant loneliness.
I also noticed that some people have a kind of resiliency about being able to reach out and connect in almost any circumstance. Some of these people are shy, in fact, and yet have this ability or need to reach out to another in the supermarket line, with the cashier, bumping into someone walking down the street, just a look in somebody else's eyes and a nod, if not words.
And, you know, my guess would be, I don't know if you're talking about anyone you have in mind in particular, but there's some people who, in the same way that some people don't look lonely and truly are, there's some people who look like they might be lonely, but truly are not. And there's some people who, for example, maybe they live alone, maybe they don't have a ton of friends, but in fact they're not lonely because they do have that ability to reach out and connect in the supermarket, to start a conversation online at the theater, and they're just naturally good at reaching out and connecting to people, and they don't perhaps experience loneliness, even though other people might say, well, they don't seem to have a lot of people in their lives, but they don't feel it. That's why it's the subjective definition. It's whether the person feels that acute pang of emotional or social or both loneliness, and that's what determines whether you're at risk for all these health factors. I mean, it really shaves years of someone's life. There's one study that says it increases your risk of an early death by 14%. Mm. So that's a huge thing.
This is Manhattan psychologist and Psychology Today blogger Dr. Guy Winch. He's author of Emotional First Aid. It's about practical strategies for treating the everyday hurts, the rejection, failure, guilt, all those everyday psychological injuries so that you can be at your best no matter what life ends up tossing at you. That is quite a story you tell in the book about the young man who has some kind of physical disability, and even from time to time has no control over the moisture in his mouth, and so he can drool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he tried so many things to connect with people and at school, and it was rough because people just didn't want to connect. And then he finally found something.
He finally found something. I just want to say, this young man, you know, he had a significant disability. He had one of those chronic physical injuries that has outward manifestations. And so you looked at him, you can tell there's something wrong. And this is the problem that a lot of people with disabilities have, because as a society, we don't do a very good job about teaching young people about people with disabilities, about acceptance. People tend to stare at people with disabilities. People tend to, feel there's something wrong with them. People tend to, you know, really have a hard time connecting with them. It's extremely unfortunate because they have a physical disability or otherwise, but that's the only thing that's wrong with them. Now, this young man, again, one of the signs was when he got excited, he would forget to swallow and he would start drooling. And boy, is that going to hurt a teenager growing up when you have some disabilities that are obvious in the first place and then you're drooling. So he was really shunned. He had such trouble making connections with anyone. And his hope was, okay, he goes to college. These are no longer high school students. It's adults. Surely people would look past his disability. And then he goes to the first class, and he sits there reading the sports section in the paper, as he does before every class. And he said, literally, that the room was pretty full, except no one would sit next to him. There was like a radius around him of empty chairs, because no one wanted to sit next to the weird-looking kid. And he was very well aware, you know, of that. And so he tried sitting in another location. Wherever he went, the radius went with him, and people kind of... And the only way he ended up connecting was that he would get there early, and he would look at the sports section, and a few other, actually male students, would get there early and look at the sports section. And he was a Yankee fan. It wasn't something that you would not pick out about him. He was always with his Yankee cap and other Yankee kind of attire at times. And he was a very, very smart, astute Yankee fan. He listened to all the shows. He had a really, really sophisticated level of knowledge about the Yankees. And he started, two people were talking, and he broke into the conversation with some of the things that he knew about the Yankees and his thoughts about them. And it was so compelling what he was saying that the two other guys there were like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then they would all get there early to class, and they would always talk about the Yankees. And his moment of triumph was one time he was late, and he heard one guy say to the other, "Where's the Yankee kid?" And it was the first time he'd ever been referred to as the Yankee kid. He'd always been referred to, "Where's that Spaz or the Drooler or some kind of other horrible, horrible name." And here he was being thought of, and the word disability wasn't anywhere there, and there was nothing about disability in that statement.
Yeah.
And for him, it was so affirming. He went through a lot to get to that moment.
Dr. Guy Winch, author of Emotional First Aid, please stay with us. And if you'd like to call in and make a comment or ask a question, do so at 203-776-WNPR, and we'll be right back. Mm-hmm. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. I wanted to let you know, save the date, Thursday, June 19th. You are invited to attend and be a top judge at the Faith Middleton Fudgemuth Martini Competition. CPTV will be there to film, and you get to wander from cocktail station to cocktail station to try what these innovative bartenders are doing, and you have a ballot and you vote the king or queen of Connecticut in the martini competition. Innovative martinis. Vote for your favorite cocktail. And there's great, great dancing. It is one of the hottest tickets around. It's a sellout experience. To compete as a bartender or to attend as a guest, go online right now to ctmartini.org. That's ctmartini.org. Tickets are $65 each to benefit WNPR and CPTV. It is at the Riverview in Simsbury, Connecticut this time. Can't wait for this event. We are talking with Dr. Guy Winch. He has done this book, Emotional First Aid, Practical Strategies for Treating Those Everyday Wounds. This is the stuff that a life can send your way. Failure, rejection, guilt, all, you know the list. So let's get to guilt. This is so common with people that we have people arguing over whether a particular religion produces more guilt than another. We're probably wired for this too, don't you think?
I think we are wired for guilt. It's all of those things are a result of us being social animals that evolved in social groups, and so there are all these evolutionary traits we have and wiring that we have that to preserve group dynamics and the group cohesion and the nature of the group. And guilt, you know, socially is one of those emotions.
I had somebody say to me the other day, I wouldn't be friends with so-and-so if we didn't have this long history together. And so I feel guilty when I don't call and on with this. And I was looking, I thought, well, that's an intriguing category. That's one I haven't heard in a long time.
I'm afraid to stop the friendship because I'd feel guilty.
Yeah, breaking up with a friend.
Yeah, well, you know, it depends why. I mean, sometimes somebody can feel, yeah, we just don't have as much in common, and sometimes the friendship is really not a great friendship to that specific person. And you know, you might feel guilty of breaking up with someone even though they're really not bringing much to the friendship. You know, sometimes the friendship can be based, you know, you can have met someone, for example, when they're in a very bad time in their lives, and so they're this, you know, they're very, very needy, and it's all about them and all about their misery, and that's how that friendship is formed. But then time goes on, they get into a better place, but still it's all about them, still it's all about their misery, and you mm-hmm. don't get much stage time with them. And so, you know, it could be that you might feel, I'm not really not getting much out of that friendship at this point. But guilt is indeed, it's one of those emotions psychologically. There's a lot of things like this psychologically that in small doses is great and in large doses is terrible. And it's great in small doses because it serves a real important function. I mean, guilt usually, it triggers an alarm. It signals us when we are about to or have done something that can cause harm to another person, whether it's practical, real harm, emotional harm, mm-hmm. what have you. And it alerts us so that we can either not do the thing we were planning of doing or correct the thing we did by a heartfelt apology or remember to call the person on their birthday, maybe we were just about to forget. So if it's an alarm, as long as the alarm goes off, we hit the button and correct the action, we're good to go. But when our guilt is unresolved, when it just lingers, then that's as if the snooze alarm is going off in our brain every 10 minutes. And as you can imagine, if an alarm is going off in your brain every 10 minutes, that can be pretty distracting. And so really, when guilt is unrelenting, when it's unresolved, when it's severe, it's very, very distracting. It really impacts our mood. It makes us very unwilling and uninterested in enjoying life. You know, when we feel really guilty about something, we won't want to go to the party because we don't feel like enjoying ourselves. And in certain studies, people, after being made to feel guilty for really minor things, like, you know, if this is a study of college students, one would have done something that caused the other to not receive a couple of lottery tickets, which who knows if they were even worthwhile, the tickets, but, you know, something small like that. And then as a result, result, when they came time to get the payment for the experiment, instead of choosing DVDs or movie tickets, they would choose something like school supplies, because they didn't really want to enjoy themselves. They didn't feel worthy of having a good time when they were feeling guilty. And even there are those who would resort to self-punishment when they feel guilty. So guilt can really do a number on us. When it's unrelenting, when it's unresolved.
Guy Wench, you know what I'm thinking? That guilt has a kind of built-in sneakiness to it. I don't even think it would be called guilt if it weren't so resistant to self-awareness. You know, that's a very bad way of saying it is hard to confess to guilt, to even understand that you're having it. You know what I mean? It's very sneaky in its way. There's something that makes you feel, because you are guilty, it's harder than, I think, anything else to cop to.
I think it's harder to admit to the action that caused the guilt. I think people know when they're feeling guilty. It's pretty clear when somebody's feeling guilty. It's not a feeling you can just toss aside that easily. Now, you might have a hard time admitting to yourself, for example, certainly to others, what it is you've done, or the impact, or maybe your intention wasn't bad at all, but it had a very bad outcome. So some people would have a hard time admitting to the culpability of the actual action. But if you ask them in their own heart, are you feeling guilty, they probably would very quickly say, yes, I am feeling guilty.
I think it's one of those things that you want to, you know, stuff down, shove away, not look at. And so that you might be, I mean, I certainly can think of times when I've been reluctant to confront my own guiltiness. I'm really thinking here the most about the caretaker, someone who's taking care of somebody who's sick, and how normal it is, how easy it is, and how ashamed they feel angry and then guilty. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, who goes in that category as well? Mothers who just had their first child. Because it's so overwhelming, and there's so many, many women who feel so overwhelmed and have moments of such real resentment towards the newborn. It is the most unpolitically correct thing to say. Most mothers will not really admit that to one another. No one's going to the mommy group saying, I had a fantasy of smothering that child the other day. No one's saying that. But a lot of women are feeling it. They're feeling this resentment of this, even at the same time. And it's not to say they don't love their child. It's not to say they're not good mothers. They can be great mothers. They can really love their child and still have moments of massive resentment and anger and frustration, about which they then feel extraordinarily guilty. And like you said, and that's not one of those things that they're going to go and advertise and talk about. Therapists get to hear about it in the privacy and the sanctity of the therapy room. And even there, people squirm, and women often will squirm quite a bit before admitting it. And when they do, they think they're saying the most shameful thing, because what kind of mothers are they that they're saying it? But indeed, many, many women feel this way. And it's certainly true of caretakers, too. Anything in which you have to give of yourself so completely and so selflessly, it's natural that you would feel moments of rejection. It's natural, of resentment. It's natural that you would feel moments of real kind of anger and frustration, and then feel really bad, because the person you're feeling that about is either, this newborn infant, or somebody who's already suffering tremendously or very disabled. So, yes, the guilt can come with it, but really those are very natural feelings.
203-776-9677. We are talking with Dr. Guy Wench, who's a practicing psychologist in Manhattan. Has done this book, Emotional First Aid, looking at strategies for handling those everyday wounds that come everybody's way: failure, rejection, guilt, rumination. This is where people get hurt, we get hurt, and then we start with the story in our minds. And that story can get so complicated, be so endless, surprise you by how often it returns, until you suddenly realize, what am I doing?
And probably by the time you realize that, it might be a little too late, in the sense that the more you tend to ruminate about something, and rumination, you know, refers to brooding and dwelling on something, an incident from the past. If you're brooding about something that's coming up, it's more worry than rumination, really. So you're thinking about an instance from the past when your boss yelled at you in front of all your colleagues, or when your friends made a joke at your expense at the party, or something like that, or you know, the breakup conversation that somebody had with you, and you will go over that scenario in your mind over and over and over again. And the problem with rumination, the problem with brooding like that, is that it's not productive. There are forms of self-reflection which are absolutely productive, and in a productive form of that, you would think about that, but then you would try to get some takeaways. You try to understand it, make sense of what happened, figure out some kind of conclusion, or figure out some kind of action you need to take to prevent it from happening in the future, or to get closure in the present. In other words, if you're actually going towards the goal of figuring it out, it's fine. But when you're ruminating, you're not figuring anything new out. You're just going over the same story again and again and again and again. And the problem with it is that it really does a number on us psychologically. It really is it's almost like a golden path to depression, because when you do that very habitually, you're thinking of the world in such negative terms. You're spending so much time thinking of all the bad things that happened, even if it's the one bad thing, over and over and over again. It really starts to color the world in those terms. And by just going over it without doing something about it, you get used to stewing instead of doing. In one study, they looked at women who had a tendency to ruminate, and they found that women who found a lump in their breast and had a tendency to ruminate, as opposed to women who found a lump in their breast and did not, the women who tended to ruminate waited 2 months to make an appointment with their doctor. Much more than the women who didn't tend to ruminate. And why? Because they were so used to stewing and thinking and worrying and not doing, that the passivity became so ingrained they actually didn't take action. And it's a danger with rumination, that we get stuck in this passive, helpless victim mentality of, this bad thing happened to me and I can't get over it and I can't get over it. Mm-hmm. And you must get over it, because it really does damage to your health. It sets you up for higher risks for alcoholism, for eating disorders, for depression, even for cardiovascular disease, because every time you go over that story, you're flooding yourself with stress hormones. So it's really something that's far more damaging to us than we realize.
Yeah. I almost picture, when you talk about this, cutting a groove in the brain when you go over the same thing over and over and over again.
Yes.
And so just as athletes practice to learn a thing and be better at a thing, I guess you have to practice to jump out of that groove you've cut and start a new one.
Yes, well, I think of it as this. I mean, the analogy I would use is, you know, for those people who were ever smokers and they had to stop smoking, they're aware that when they decided to stop, they knew they were going to get hit really hard with cravings at the beginning. And they had to get through those cravings, because in time, the cravings diminish both in frequency and in intensity. And it's going to be the same with this. You have to be able to disrupt the pattern of indulging that ruminating, indulging going back to that scene over and over again. And the best way to do that is to distract yourself with something that requires a certain amount of concentration. So the minute you start thinking about that thing, hop on your phone and do a crossword puzzle or Words with Friends, or if you must, Candy Crush, or, you know, any of those things, you know, go for a quick run, or do something that's absorbing. And even 2 or 3 minutes of that kind of activity will disrupt that specific episode of rumination. But you have to do this each time. You have to disrupt it each time so the groove doesn't get deeper. I love your analogy of the groove. So that the groove doesn't get deeper. And if you do that, in time, that urge to ruminate about the incident will diminish, both in intensity and in frequency.
I wish we had time. We have some callers on the line, and here we have less than a minute left, so I'm sorry we didn't get to those calls. Very quickly, Guy Winch, intrigued that you also do stand-up comedy, because you've been very serious during this show. I wondered how it was going to go. And so how often do you do it?
Well, these days, much, much less than I used to, because the book writing and all the other, the blogging, really do take up a little bit too much time. But I was doing it quite seriously for a while. I found it to be a very interesting balance between my life, you know, as a therapist and psychologist and that, and the seriousness of that, as you see in this interview. And in general, I feel when I'm talking about serious things, I like to remain serious. If somebody's sitting at home feeling lonely or rejected, that they're not going to be that interested in me cracking jokes
Thank you, Guy. Guy Winch, author of Emotional First Aid. Thanks for being on the show. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.